Hey, thanks for joining me today on Earth Ancients. You know, we continue to broaden the program's perspective, have always touched on consciousness. Today, we'll talk a little bit with Melissa Tittle on this new series called Psychedelica that's a historic perspective on consciousness-raising herbs like mushrooms and cannabis and some of the real powerful natural herbs like the shamanic ayahuasca. And we've talked a lot about ayahuasca. We're going to head over to Colorado and speak with Mark Legere, the Mars revealer on a new face on Mars. And when I say a new face, this is one of the most amazing sculptures that is miles wide, miles long, and it is not a trick of light. This is a real face, and Mark's made what I consider a historic discovery that we'll talk about, and you can see on the Facebook page. We're going to talk about the Nephilim. Gary Wayne joins us today and discusses the biblical giants, the historic giants, and what that discovery, what that means for us today, and all the ramifications of the Nephilim from the Bible. All this and the news today on Earth Ancients. For January 27th, 2018, this is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. Hey, how you doing? It's Saturday, huh? It's Saturday. Well, it could be another day you're listening, but anyhow, it's Saturday for me, and welcome to Earth Ancients. It's that time of the week again, something new to listen to. Hey, I was going over some notes from, can you believe it, 1996, which was the first time I was in Yucatan, and at that time I was with a girlfriend, and I was looking over my photos back then. This is before they had digital cameras, and I have a folder with some of the early images I took of Chichen Itza. And back then you could climb pretty much everything. Well, there was a couple of buildings you couldn't climb, but I took some notes and some photographs after climbing the El Castillo, the castle pyramid. One of the things that I found interesting is in those days they attached a big chain to the middle, because that is a really challenging pyramid to climb. The stairs are only about, I'd say maybe 5 to 7 inches deep. And so it's a small stair. Most stairs are, I want to say maybe 10 inches, maybe even more or less, but these are small stairs. And anyhow, I got to the top, and this is the very first time, and I'm standing up there, and then something happens to you when you're up at the top there. I got hit with some kind of field of energy or something, and I was like, I mean, I'm standing there, you know, and it's a challenge to get up there, so I'm kind of huffing and puffing a little bit, and I'm standing there, and I remember walking in the tower room, and I'm hit with some kind of energy, and I'm like dizzy. I'm like, what the hell is this all about? You know, I know it was hot, it was humid, but I mean, I was in pretty good shape. And then, you know, after about 20 minutes, I go, I got to get down. You know, I was feeling better. But one of the things I noticed when I got down is there's something about these pyramids. And to this day, whenever I go on a pyramid hike or whenever I go and climb on a pyramid, I have an intention to experience what they designed into these structures. And I mean, I think they have a purpose. I think they were built. I mean, we know they were built over cenotes, pools of water. We now know that the main pyramid at Chichen Itza, which is the El Castillo, which is what I climbed, is over not only a cenote, but an underground river. So it's got flowing water. And why did they build over a cenote? We don't know. I mean, there's some form of science that is just not understood to us. We either don't have the technology to trace the energetics, which is my feeling. But why do this? Why build over flowing water, over these energy centers, these telluric fields, these ley lines? You know, why do they do this? You know, it's just a major question. And I mean, they stopped allowing people to climb El Castillo. I think it was 2005, because I was there two other times, and then in 2005 I couldn't get up there. So they said that it was tough on the pyramid; too many people were walking on it. I believe the reason was is that somebody fell off and was killed. That's a high. I mean, that's like 70, 80 feet in the air. And this woman fell and she broke her neck and that was it. I don't know if that's the reason or people were getting buzzed like I was. Hey, but it's exciting. It's exciting to climb these pyramids. Hey, if you join me in June, we're going to be in Guatemala and Honduras. We'll be climbing not only the Lost World Pyramid, which John Burke tested and found has unusual frequencies. We'll be climbing some really huge pyramids. Some of them have stairways built into the sides that allows you to climb to the very top and then transverse the entrance to the top of the pyramid. So if you want more information on that, go to earthancients.com/tours. We'll be at Tikal, we'll be at Copan, Quirligua, and some smaller places. But, you know, the experience left a huge impression on me. I think the Maya designed these pyramids for physiological effects. And again, we don't know what these effects are. I don't know if I'm going to live another 20, 30, 40 years beyond the normal age because of the energetics I've absorbed. The other thing to consider is everybody has their own frequency. They know that there's the human body has a frequency that's been tested. I mean, some of it is considered auras, but as our technology gets better and we start creating more technology to scan the body or systems to scan the body, we'll begin to understand how we integrate with our environment. And the point of that is that some people, and I've been on tours with different groups, and some people can actually sit by a pyramid, close their eyes, and pick up on what's going on energetically. I remember one time we were at Uxmal, and we were sitting and just taking a break, and some people were closing their eyes just to kind of catch their breath and take in the environment. And they were feeling various energy coming off of the pyramid, the pyramid of the magician. And so the cool thing about touring in these places is that you can actually get a sense, no matter what level of frequency you're on, you can get a sense of these pyramids. So consider coming with us in June, and come with us to some of the other touring programs we'll be doing too later in the year. By the way, I have worked pretty closely with the president of our tour company, Vital Transport, and that's Michael Lundquist. And these tours that we go on are rock bottom. I think I mentioned before that this tour to Guatemala, it's about a 1 month's rent, about $1,800 or less. You got to fly yourself down there. But hey, this is first class all the way. Food, transportation, all your permits are covered. And all you got to do is get yourself down there. And we're going to have a blast. So earthancients.com/tours. Come on down and let's do it. Earth Ancients is sponsored by Gaia. And I've been talking about this new series, Psychedelica, for about a week now. I actually had a chance to review the first two in the series, and it is outstanding. We really don't know the importance of these psychotropic plants, mushrooms, cannabis, the mixture known as ayahuasca. This series is fabulous, and you have to check it out. But the thing is, that's only one of 8,000 titles that Gaia has. These titles include the full spectrum of alien-human interaction, ancient aliens, best-selling authors, research investigators on ancient Earth civilizations from around the world. That's just not just China. That's Egypt, Mesoamerica, North America. Every country around the world is covered on Gaia. Now, one of the things I really enjoy about Gaia is its personal growth section. And this is topics like body movement, Tai Chi, yoga, but also mental wellness, all types of mental clarity, meditations. You can even learn how to meditate. And you know how much importance I place on meditation. You can learn how to meditate. 8,000 titles and growing. Gaia. Go to Gaia, GAIA.com/Earth Ancients. Hey, support them because they support Earth Ancients.
Of all the boys I've known, and I've known some.
One small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
Earth Ancient News is found on Facebook. You can also find it on earthancients.com. News from around the world. We have galleries. We have articles. We have stories. Scientists at the University of Tübingen, Germany, have discovered what looks like the cause of the plague in 1540 that basically wiped out most of the Aztec people in Mexico. Reports are of close to 25 million people died from a fever that would follow by severe headaches. 2 or 3 days later, the individual was dead. Close to the Black Plague that affected Europe in the Middle Ages, this fever, this deadly virus was brought over from the Europeans, and scientists were analyzing some skeletal remains from a number of individuals and found that this was the cause of their death. Speculation now holds that this was this great fever that is written and chronicled that wiped out the Aztecs. It's kind of scary. We have a number of galleries. One of the unique images that was sent to us by one of our readers is the head of Viracocha. This is an unusual head. No one is really familiar with any sculptures in the Americas of Viracocha, who was the great liberator of the pre-Inca people. Thought of as a god by the Inca. And this head is fairly large. It looks like it was once on a full body. It is found in Madrid, Spain, of all places, and it's a very sophisticated sculpture. The features are almost Oriental or Asian by today's standards. The figurehead is wearing a unusual headband, and Never seen this before. We don't have anything on Viracocha. Viracocha is considered a god, but this may have been the actual man himself, Viracocha in the flesh. We just don't know. Fantastic, very sophisticated by art historian standards. This is a very sophisticated sculpture. You can see it on the Facebook page in all its glory. Hugh Newman, the author of Giants, has sent us a photograph of Pakal's crypt, his sarcophagus. This is an unusual photograph because typically we see the top of this sarcophagus, this multi-ton top piece, but he has taken a photograph of the base. And what we see here is very intricate sculpture that supported the body of Pakal. And for those of you who don't know who Pakal is, he is one of the last rulers who ruled in Palenque, which is in Guatemala. And this is a beautiful rendition, a beautiful photograph that Hugh has taken of this sarcophagus, which is monstrous. It's just huge. Scientists have reconstructed the face of a 9,000-year-old Greek teenager. This is a beautiful reconstruction from a top artisan who is able to take the actual skull of this young woman and reconstruct it to its full effects of what she looked like when she was alive. Apparently, she was about 14 to 16 when she passed away. But the quality of this work is quite amazing, and I suggest that you go to the Facebook page and take a look at it. This is just a short sampling of the news that we have on Facebook and on the Earth Ancients website. Check in each week by going to Facebook, go to Earth Ancients, either group or international page, or the earthancients.com, and you will see this and regular photo galleries and information from around the world. So I wanted to check in with Gary Lejeune, the Mars Revealer. He sent me an amazing photograph. Now, we're all familiar with the face on Mars, the Mars face, which is on Cydonia. We've had Dr. John Brandenburg show us a couple of different faces. George had some kind of weak, basic, pretty decayed faces. Gary's had a few faces, too. But the one that he has, which I have on the Facebook page, is brand new. This is a new discovery. Gary, this is an amazing face. It's the best face I've seen. Tell us about it.
Thank you, Cliff. And thank you for noticing the fact to report on it. You know, many others had the opportunity to do so, but for some reason, everyone's got a mask to wear, so they're afraid to face themselves. But, but isn't it amazing, this new image? Yeah. Oh, my gosh. 3 miles long.
Wow.
By 2 to 2.5 miles wide. Very in your face. Multi-images, multi-sources. Scientists usually require 3, right, as the model. Mm-hmm. So we got multiple images from various sources, 2 or 3 sources. And even infrared data confirming this thing is there. This thing is booming at you. And it's right under everyone's noses.
Yeah.
Pun intended. That's the amazing thing about this. And you mentioned the face of Cydonia. Remember, the policy of mainstream knowledge and teaching of that is never to admit intelligent life or intelligent hands or NASA go bye-bye. But now that was a mere trick of light and shadow, indicating a single trick. It was, the excuse tricks of light and shadow is just a pile of rocks, hit pieces showing it upside down over the years through Mars Global Surveyor and onward. Until it's like, well, hey, one nice hit piece of the high rise from MRO going over it we want more imagery of it. I want different times of the year or different positions every 5 years because of how Earth may, I mean, how Mars may shift in its sun angling, because like our Earth, as our Earth moves, the, you know, we get the shifting of seasons. Well, not only that, it also shows off what light hits where at whatever point in time, where these phases are not only there, they're designed with that aspect to show more detail and or to show certain things upon certain dates, like solstices unto itself.
Interesting. You know, so do you think this is designed so that as the sun passes over it, it kind of isn't highlighted? Because, I mean, the shot that we're seeing here has the top of the head highlighted with the sun and just some of the tip of the nose. But do you think it's designed to pick up aspects of the sun passing over?
Oh, definitely. The whole, not only that face, but everything it sits on. In my opinion, the entire planet was sculpted on that grid-like type pattern, snake scale type, fish scale-like, geometrical designing, a spider web within a spider web with an intelligent tattooist artist gone mad mindset, and how this surface was sculpted. And in order to know that, the sun, we make a big deal about solstices here. Think about, for the very own features, just put all global wide, let alone a structure.
Wow.
That's what makes it incredible to where, did you know this, everybody, and Cliff, that Mars every so many years, as this happens, this rings true. The Japanese noticed it. Years later, we have noticed it, our scientists, that it throws flashes out. It throws beams of light up. From where? Not from a power, but by its reflectiveness of how the planet moves. And at certain times, at certain periods of its orbits, it will hit those lights. And maybe an observer in another solar system or galaxy could pick up that light, maybe as a beacon to them, letting them know the status of its position in our solar system. I mean, there's many things, or even transferring data for all we know, right? Yeah. I mean, it's not far-fetched. I mean, right? So this is the implications here. It's astounding because you're talking about that Mars Odyssey shot, the latest one, the lower resolution, but because of the sun angle and the way that it is, I could compare it to when I first discovered it in many years ago, 2007, 2008. No, I think it was 2006. But anyway, a Mars Express image to where I was like, whoa, I seen a face. And to me, it looked all grainy and everything. But no, I had to process it from the raw. And I was like, boy, look, that's a face. But then I would need other data. So I started looking through NASA data and trying to Mars Global Surveyor caught the, in early 2000s, caught the top head, Mars Global Surveyor, run by Mike Malin Space Science Systems. Right. He only caught the top of the head and it was screwed. No one knew about that then. All right. So, and no one had seen this then. But then years later, we got Mars Odyssey. I started looking. Boom. Lo and behold. But it didn't look like the image in Mars Express. And that, to me, that confirmed my theory that we would see things differently at different angles or different times or positions in orbit. But either way, it would take time. So when I was finally able to get a view from NASA close to Mars Express, you got to understand how ecstatic I was because this thing is showing something. For one, it confirms Mars Express image. No one can say, oh, again, the trick of light and shadow, nothing's there. We're getting confirming data to where even MRO has taken imagery. Yeah. We have that imagery, and it all is astounding. It's all there. The eye, where the eye would be, the shape of the face, the triangular pyramid mound that it sits on, that is fused in to what would look like a cliffside, but is actually, in my opinion, a city.
We're tight on time here. So we want to do this new pyramid. It's a Martian pyramid. It's over a mile by a mile. It's a three-sided, beautifully shaped pyramid, and you have calculated that it's over 500 feet high. That's a monstrous pyramid. Talk a little bit about it. It's a perfectly shaped pyramid, too.
Well, the way to tell the perfectly shaped, it looks like it from above. But what we need is higher resolution, the 3D map, topographical map data, not low res like you see on Google Earth. Again, you know what I mean? That's low res. especially the one for Mars. It helps, but there's a lot of places that obviously you can tell by the pictures you should be seeing stuff and you're not seeing nothing because of what's there, you know, is not flat. So anyway, but I digress. There is height there, and judging by that and using that calculations, me figuring out, yes, it, at least 450 feet and above, but not more than 550. All right. It's by like a mile point 32 wide from like rounded edge around the thing, the circumference of it, 1.23 miles around the circumference of it. So that's interesting. And but like you said, it looks like a three-sided pyramid beaming right at you. You know, so I provided a Mars Express image as well as an MRO image. And again, the MRO imagery, you know, we need more data. And we don't just need one shot. We got to all demand them for the data to be released, not just give us, yeah, here's a SWAT, there's a SWAT, when they're collecting thousands. You see, what I want to see their maps, and you do too. Yeah. Again, the Mars they now know ain't looking like the Mars we now know, I guarantee you. And I'm on the hunt. And that's why the faces of Mars and that face cliff and this pyramid, the Martian revelation is coming, and it's going to be upon you all.
Perfect.
And I appreciate you. And now I know you're dying and everyone wants to know. For this one, I'll give you the coordinates. Okay, it's 28 north by 37 west. So okay. Look in that area. Again, 28 north, 37 west.
Okay, for those of you listening, you can see this on the Facebook, Earth Ancients Facebook, and I'll also link it to Gary's Facebook, and you can see all of his research on his page. Gary, as always, you're a master. You are the Mars revealer. Thanks a lot, and we'll get back to you.
I appreciate it, Cliff. And remember, everybody, the Martian revelation comes. Don't get scared. Be aware. Good night, Cliff.
Excellent.
Your beautiful little baby, you were the one I almost drove myself crazy, and it's hard, but believe me, I'm sitting here next to...
So we're checking in with Melissa Tittle. We haven't talked to Melissa, boy, in over a month. Melissa, how you doing?
I know, it's been forever. I'm good.
I know. Happy New Year's to you, even though we're at the end of the month. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too.
Thank you. All right. Hey, well, listen, I got this. I actually saw the first program, Psychedelica, which is a very cool, I guess it's kind of a historical look from the past to the present, possibly the future, on psychedelics. Talk a little bit about this. It's very, very cool. I really enjoyed the first episode.
Well, now that weed is legal in California, I'm sure you did.
We won't talk about that, but hey.
Okay. Yeah, this new series is called Psychedelica. There's about 15 episodes.
15,
and,
okay.
And what's really fascinating about this is that, you know, whether you are into psychedelics or not into psychedelics, you know a little bit about it. But I think what people don't usually know is all the really ancient ties that the psychedelics have.
Yeah.
They were used, like, you know, there wasn't people addicted to psychedelics as, you know, some mainstream people might think. It's just some very fascinating research done by some major people in this field. Mm-hmm. It's just really fascinating, because then you start to think of it as, this is all part of our journey as humans, is to help, you know, to see the other side. And ancient humans really relied on this knowledge because they knew that they were living in some kind of, you know, this probably is not their words, but they were living in some kind of 3D matrix, and they knew that they could transcend to another one and they could see outside of it. And that was the most important part of growth for that tribe or that community. Yeah. So that important message in this series of Psychedelica.
It's amazing that these naturally occurring mushrooms and cannabis strains and other psychotropic herbs are so plentiful, and our ancestors used them quite regularly and understood how to use them. And now that they're becoming more legalized, I'm just wondering what that means for people's consciousness. I think it's a good thing. I really do, because they've legalized all this, or they're going to legalize a lot of it. So, I mean, what's the outgrowth of these, of this 15 part series? Is it kind of give us a perspective, and then what we can expect, or is it a predicting, or what? What is the theme of the overall program?
I wouldn't say predicting. I think that you were right on when you said, you know, what is this going to do for our consciousness? I think that that's like the end point on the episodes. You know, is this helping us, you know, grow as a community, as a civilization, as a tribe, right? Mm-hmm. But I think we need to understand what's happening to our bodies and our minds first. And I think that's what this series really goes into. And we hear from people like Graham Hancock.
Yeah. I saw Graham there. Yeah.
And Rick Strassman, who kind of facilitates DMT, the spirit molecule. Dennis McKenna, Terrence McKenna's brother. Yeah. I mean, he's Stan Groff, who was one of the first people to experiment with LSD, and Ralph Metzer, who worked with Timothy Leary on a lot of the stuff. So we get to hear from people that looked upon it as research. And I think that's what this series kind of gets into. It's like, let's just get into the nuts and bolts of what's happening inside your body scientifically.
Yeah.
And how that's transcending your consciousness outside of your body.
Yeah, it's a stellar lineup. I was extremely impressed to see the people that you had on the program. And they're all not just briefly talking about it. They're really getting into it. It's a very heady program. Psychedelica, you can see it by going to gaia.com/Earth Ancients. And, of course, you can start with the 99-cent trial. And what is it up to now? I always say 7,600. Have you guys crossed over 8,000 titles yet, or no? What is it?
Maybe. I'm working so much. They need to have like a test.
I'm turning them up, buddy. I'm turning up these shows.
I got my nose in the grind.
Okay. We'll say close to 8,000 titles. How's that?
Perfect. I love
it. Yeah. So there you go. Gaia.com/Earth Ancients. Hey, Melissa, next time we get you on the program, hopefully that'll be soon, we can hear about what you have in the works. Because last time we talked to you, you were like, oh, I can't really talk about it. It's just too... It's
top secret.
Yeah.
Yes. Hopefully I will have some answers for everybody in February. Because there's a lot of stuff I've been working on that I'm just waiting for everything to be greenlit. Okay. Some really exciting stuff. Some really cool things that we have not done here yet at Gaia. So
Inside the mind of Melissa Tittle. Fantastic. Melissa,
Gary,
have a great day, and we'll look forward to talking to you again.
All right. Thank you.
Today's interview is brought to you by Vital Transport. And I wanted to mention that for those of you who are thinking of joining me on the Secrets of Guatemala tour, June 15th through the 24th, 2018, you should join us. If you've been worried about money, that should not be the issue, because Vital Transport has a new financial package. It's basically, you can finance your travel. And this is something that rarely happens. But this is great if you're tight, if you're worrying about taxes. Don't worry anymore. This is something that really makes Vital Travel one of the top agencies out there, allowing you to book a tour with us, pay for it when you get back. So I got Mike Lundquist on the phone. And this is really critical, isn't it, Mike? We can pretty much finance anybody, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, of course, you know, it's based on credit scores and things like that. But, you know, our price is reasonable, as you talked about. And, you know, we've teamed up with a company called BlissPay to offer special financing. And the people that finance with us will enjoy no payments, no interest on all purchases over $199, which, you know, of course, our trip is. And as long as that's paid in full within 6 months, they actually have no interest. And so this is a way to actually, you know, improve your credit and, you know, finance it very similar to, you know, like Apple Computer or some of your other technological devices. And then also they're, you know, running a promo now that you'll get 2% cash back as well. And so basically how it works, and if people want to see if, you know, they can actually apply without, you know, giving you a call or giving me a call or anything, if they just go to BlissPay, BLISPAY.com. And then /vital transport.
Okay.
That's blisspay.com/vital transport.
Okay. Now, Secrets of Guatemala is June 15th through the 24th. We all fly into Guatemala City. Now, what Mike just told me recently was something that I didn't even think about. He will help you with your entire trip, including the airfare. So he'll help you find him. Mike and his team at Vital Transport will find you your airfare. They'll book your flight and then also add you into our group, our tour group. And that is unheard of. Nobody does that. Usually it's just you got to cover your tour package and then you got to figure out the money to fly. Now he can do the whole thing, which really makes this great. So check it out. Go to earthancients.com/tours. It's totally on there. We are climbing the pyramids. I just posted a new ad today with all the pyramids we'll be climbing. We'll be at Tikal. We'll be at Quetzalcoatl. We'll be at Copan. And there are pyramids at each one of those places. Come on and join us. And you are going to have a blast. It's going to be one of those killer events to check out. Hey, Mike, thanks for your time. This is going to be fun, isn't it?
Keep it coming. And if anybody has questions about the financing, please let me know. Toll free 844-368-4825.
Secrets of Guatemala, June 15th through the 24th this year. Come out and join me. We're always looking for new topics here on Earth Ancients, and the topic of giants crossed my screen here recently. We had one of our producers on the East Coast sent me some information about a book called The Genesis 6 Conspiracy, How Secret Societies and the Descendants of God Planned to Enslave Humankind. And I was like, oh my God, what's going on here? So I had a chance to look at some of the material in this book. We have the author on today. His name is Gary Wayne. Gary is a Christian contrarian. We're going to ask him what a contrarian is here in a minute, because that's an interesting term, who has maintained a lifelong love affair with biblical prophecy, history, and mythology. And his extensive study has encompassed the Holy Bible, the Gnostic scriptures, the Quran, and a number of other sacred texts. But the focus of this book has to do with the Nephilim. And we've had a number of authors on the program who have spoken to us about the Nephilim. And for those of you who are not familiar with Nephilim, Nephilim are the giants, the giant humans that are featured in the Bible. Many of you know we've had research investigators who have followed Zechariah Sitchin's work on the Nephilim. But this is more of a focus today on another aspect of the Nephilim. So I'm looking forward to this interview. Gary Wayne, how are you?
I am very well and so happy to be joining you on your show today and looking forward to maybe connecting some dots and maybe presenting a few things that perhaps your audience hasn't heard before. So very excited to be here.
Great. Okay, well, let's hit it right off the bat here. What's a Christian contrarian? What's a contrarian? I'm curious.
Well, a contrarian is somebody, and this is my definition, but I think it's pretty close to the sort of standard definition, is I don't believe what somebody says about something, or what somebody says is written in a book or something to that effect. I'm one of those people who needs to try and verify it myself. Mm-hmm. And then I put weight in behind whether do I think that's accurate or do I not. And so whether or not it's my approach to the Bible, I do it the same way. I don't accept just what people say about it. I researched it thoroughly myself, just as I did all the different mythologies around the world, all of the different religions around the world. Mm-hmm. And I read for myself. And I do at times get into trouble with some people because I'm kind of a stickler for accuracy. And if they misquote something that's in the Quran or is in the Vedas, or, you know, what they heard about mythology or something, I tend to correct them on it. So bit of a stickler that way.
are we going to get I assume that you're a fundamentalist and we're going to get that perspective. Would you say that Gary Wayne is a fundamentalist Christian, or are you what do they call that? There's various versions of that. What is your perspective?
I don't belong to any particular sect. I find that they're all good in some ways and not so good in other ways. So, mm-hmm. and my family is Catholic, and so I have a pretty wide variety of a perspective. I was brought up in several different denominations, but I come from my views from what I read in the Bible. Okay. And I'm a literalist. So I'm not into the allegorical interpretation that the Gnostics would bring to the Bible and others would bring to the Bible. I read it literally. I also like to take it back to Hebrew and the original Greek, so I understand it correctly. Okay. And understand different types of words and how it's applied.
Now, is your basic tool of research the Bible, or are you also researching other forms of ancient texts when we talk about the Nephilim?
Yeah, I'm a real fan of getting into different texts, and I'm a history buff and I'm a mythology buff. So if I'm going to talk about Sumerian mythology, I'm going to go to, like Ninurta's Pride or the Luma Elish or something to that effect, or the Epic of Gilgamesh. Mm-hmm. I'm going to, if I'm going to refer out of Greek mythology, I probably will go to somebody like Homer, or I will quote Plato. And so I go right to the original sources when I can. Sometimes my route getting there is through other sources, but you still need to verify at that end.
Okay, gotcha. Now, before we jump into this book, I have to ask you this. We have a lot of research investigators on the program who do work on giant dwellings here in the Americas. The United States of America has a number of areas that have dwellings that are thought to have been from giant human beings. And we have people who speak about European giants. We have a number of people who speak on the Nephilim. What makes your book different from the other stories of ancient giants?
Well, what I do is I connect more dots, and I tell more of a complete story of the ancient giants and the effect that they had on the ancient world. Mm-hmm. And how those descendants and progeny and bloodlines survived, and the organizations that were created around them, how they survived. And so I bring not only a biblical aspect, I'll bring in a historical, other religious, other mythologies aspect, and bring it all together. That is amazing when you do that. You get almost an identical story of similar events, almost like parallel accounts of the same types of events all over the world. And they all tell the same story. They just have a different cultural or vernacular or religious lens that they're telling it through. Mm-hmm. And so I put all of that together. And then where I end up is I talk through history, how it's affected our history, what's going on with these groups, bloodlines, and organizations today, and how they will impact our future.
Okay. All right. Well, let's get into it. The book, The Genesis 6 Conspiracy, How Secret Societies and Descendants of the Giants Plan to Enslave Humankind. What's your take on the Nephilim? Now, you know, Sitchin talks about them being overlords, aliens who came. Were they offspring of aliens? What's your take on the Nephilim?
Well, when Sitchin talks about Nephilim, he's kind of talking more about the Sumerian aspect. And, you know, he separates Anunnaki from Igigi, and there's a couple of different groups that are going on there. Mm-hmm. When I look at the Nephilim and I look at all of the other accounts, they tell a very, very consistent story around the world in terms of who they are, what they were, and how they were created. And so I've read Sitchin. I'm quite familiar with his work, and I know he's done some a lot of translating right from Sumerian, but not everybody agrees with his conclusions on that, which is not unusual, right? But because those languages always don't translate in the most clearest of way, especially when you're dealing with cuneiform and pictograms and things like that, they can convey different meanings. And so Nephilim, from my perspective, is, I'll tell the Christian one and link the other versions in as well, but they come from the sons of God, which are the angels. And in this case, seraphim watcher angels, as the book of Enoch will talk about, and seraph coming out of the book of Isaiah, which were fiery serpent-like beings. And they are considered, depending on who you talk to, either the highest level in the angelic order or second highest, whether it's cherubim or seraphim. They're both around the throne of God. But it's these watcher angels, these seraphim angels, who are the ones who will choose women, humans, females of their choice around the world and procreate to create the Nephilim, who are giants and giant demigods with an immortal spirit in the first generation being implanted into those human beings. And these were the heroes of old. They were the kings of old. They usurped the kingships in the antediluvian epoch or before the flood, and also again afterwards as they crossed the flood. Now, when we take this story and say, okay, how does that fit with other accounts around the world? You have not only a flood story, not only pyramids on all continents and all cultures, but you have a creation of both humans and you have a creation of both giants. And so let's say if you take the Greek mythology and out of Atlantis and from Plato of Critias and Timaeus, talks about Poseidon as being the god of the oceans and brother of Zeus. He mates with a human female called Clymene and produces 10 giant demigod Titans. And Titans are just another word for Nephilim, just as Anunnaki would be another word for Nephilim in the Sumerian mythology, just as you could take out of the subcontinent of India, they've got several different names for them. It's like the Asuras, the Daitya, the Danua. You've got the Myosi out of China. You've got Zibalba out of the Kisha Maya. You've got the Tengu out of Japan. And, of course, mm-hmm. you have the heroes and the titans of the Greek mythology and many more names around the world. And they're all created in the same way. And what's interesting as you get into the word demigod, as you take that back to its ancient meaning, or the word hero back to its ancient meaning as opposed to what we understand it today, to be more accurate, a hero is the offspring of the gods in the ancient color, in the ancient culture, that produces demigods and the titans and the heroes of old.
Let me stop you right there. So a demigod, to my mind, would be like Hercules, right?
Exactly. Okay. Or Theseus or Perseus or any of the other, or Atlas. I mean, there's many, many different
are those good guys or bad? I thought Hercules was a good guy.
Well, in Greek mythology, there are some what they would term good ones, and there are ones that they would deem as evil ones. In fact, Hercules went through kind of what I would call a romp in the ancient world, mm-hmm. Killing some of these very vicious warrior, titan, evil demigods, right? And so in the polytheist accounts, you kind of get both. But the consensus, whether it's monotheist accounts or it's polytheist or mythology account, is that whether or not they started out as being good, and also looking after the better interests of humankind, is that their evil nature, which they attribute to the human side as opposed to the God side, starts to take over. And they become more evil as they go and become these evil tyrants that are not only warring with themselves, but they're also warring with humans, and they're eating humans, and they're drinking their blood, and they're destroying the environment. And in fact, in the Atlantean account, they're trying to actually take over the whole world, but the Athenians are going to check them, and they don't get the golden age of a world government that they're after in the Plato account of Atlantis. And so you had Theseus and Hercules fighting on the side of Zeus to defeat the giants that are, you know, fighting for the god Poseidon.
Earth Ancients is brought to you by Gaia, and this month Gaia extends their special offer. For just 99 cents, you get complete access to over 8,000 titles on everything from ancient aliens, ancient Earth cultures around the world, and tons of personal growth topics from yoga, meditation, tai chi, and the list goes on and on. For more information, go to gaia.com/Earth Ancients. That's GAIA.com/Earth Ancients. I want to bring up Atlantis here in a minute because you do talk about Atlantis, and I find that's fascinating. But you in this book describe an evolution of these beings, and you even get into present day. How does this bloodline continue from the deluge? The deluge, the biblical deluge, is never given a date. And we've had a number of research investigators now, and now it's becoming clear that there was a catastrophe on Earth that happened approximately 12,000 years ago, which resulted in a massive series of mega floods. So I guess my question to you is and pretty much everything on the Earth was destroyed. There were surviving areas. Göbekli Tepe is apparently a place that was a kickstart for humanity in the Middle East. Pumapunku, possibly in South America, may have been another place. Teotihuacan in Mexico. There's these little islands of refuge. But I'm just curious, how would these Nephilim survive into present day?
Okay, so you have a number of ways that would happen. And the first thing I'm going to do is quote Genesis 6, in case there's some Christians out there that are wanting me to talk from that perspective as well. It says in Genesis 6:4 is that there were giants in those days and also after that, when the sons of God came to the daughters of men and they bare with them the mighty men, which were the men of renown, to paraphrase it. So they're at that time of the flood and they're also possibly afterwards. And we know they show up biblically afterwards because you have the Rephaim, you have the Avim, you have the Emin, you have the Zamzuzin, you have the Horim, and on and on and on of all these different tribes of giants showing up after the flood that don't go back to the Table of Nations, which are the descendants of Noah and his wife and his three sons and their wife, who we are told the only ones who survived the flood. Although, if we want to split a little bit of hairs in Genesis, it also said God said he was only going to destroy what he created. And clearly, it's the sons of God or the rebellious fallen angels who created the Nephilim in Genesis 6. And so I think this is why you have all of these different accounts around the world about giants surviving the flood. Because somehow they do, but my favorite way of sort of reconciling it is, and I have, you know, three different ways that this could be done in sort of big buckets. But my favorite one is a second impassioned violation against the laws of creation by the fallen angels who weren't put in the abyss for that crime before the flood. And you have a second recreation shortly after the flood, because you also see these giant nations showing up by the time of Abraham and in great numbers. And of course, in other records with Nimrod, there the giants are already then. This is 100 years after the flood. So they show up very quickly after the flood. So in the Gnostic accounts, they talk about the giants being reproduced in Sodom and Gomorrah in the cities of the plain. My second favorite account is like, let's go with the Epic of Gilgamesh as the classic example. And it's the oldest surviving flood story, but it seems to be more of a parallel account to me. But in it, you get two possibilities of how this happens in terms of giants showing up after the flood. So Gilgamesh is two-thirds God and one-third human. And it's odd that this name Gilgamesh shows up in the Dead Sea Scrolls in the Book of Giants on 4:2:5:3:1 through 5:3:4. And one wonders whether or not he survives the flood or he's just named after a giant in the story of an antediluvian giant. Of course, within the story, he's created in the typical Anunnaki manner after the flood, and then and Akeddu or Enkidu, depending on which translation you're working from, is created as an offset to Gilgamesh because he's this evil giant. So as the epic progresses, they get to the flood story, and it's talking about Utmatishtin or Zayazudra, depending again on which translation you're referring to, who is the survivor of the flood, and he takes all of his family. And he is also two-thirds God and one-third human, just as Enkidu is in Gilgamesh. And so is all of his family. And he's the archetypical Nephilim or Anunnaki. Mm-hmm. And so you have here a impassioned second violation against the laws of creation after the flood, and you have another ark story that seems to be a parallel account. Just as in the Greek mythology, you have Deucalion and Pyrrha surviving the flood, which everybody says is the Greek Noah, except that Deucalion is the son of Prometheus. And Prometheus is both a Titan demigod and a Titan god, just as you've got Anunnaki, where earthborn and heavenborn. There's two different groups. One's the offspring, one's the parent. Mm-hmm. And so no matter how you slice it, Deucalion is a Nephilim or a Titan. And this is another parallel account of a giant flood survival story, just as you've got ark stories around the world of humans surviving the flood. So I think you've got different accounts through different lenses and different cultures and languages and, exactly, and religions, yeah, telling similar accounts, and probably in several different nations, right? In several different civilizations.
Mm-hmm. So we have a scientific perspective now that this broken up planet threw out asteroids, and this is what caused this huge catastrophe which befell the Earth, resulting in a number of these mega floods. In your version, what is the cause of the flood? Of course, God wants to wipe off the Nephilim, but what is your belief on that?
Well, it's more than the cause of the flood is coming from God, and in other cultures, it's the gods who are trying to wipe out the rebellious giants because they've turned the world into a mess. So again, similar stories wherever you go on this. And so when I look at the flood story in the Bible, it's more than just the floodwaters coming up from, you know, the bowels of the earth and some rain starting to come down for the first time. Mm-hmm. I think it's very, very similar to what is being told in the Atlantean accounts or the Sumerian accounts or Gnostic accounts, is that it's a conflagration of events. Mm-hmm. And it started by, I think, asteroids, because if you look at legends that come out of the Kishimaya and ziggurats or pyramids that they built after the flood and a temple dedicated to these asteroids that start the ocean or in the same thing in the account of Enmer Akar and the ziggurat at Eridu and the temple of Enki, a gang dedicated to the not only the god that helped save them from the flood, but which is Enki, and to the asteroids that start the flood. And that's a similar Babel account, by the way, the account at Eridu. You have this understanding around the world that the Pleiades is connected to the start of the flood catastrophe, and it becomes more than just a flood. You've got earthquakes, you've got volcanoes going off, you've got earth crust being shattered, you've got, you know, cities going underwater, land being raised, and I think it changes things completely if you look at all of the collective accounts that are out there. And in the Bible, you also have this connection that comes back into other books of the Bible that are clearly talking about this greater flood catastrophe and connecting the Pleiades with them. And I quote all of that in the book, and I won't do all of that right now.
Right.
So I think when people are looking for this silver bullet sign of the flood, they have to look in a broader level. I think they're looking that it's got to be the same level of silt everywhere on the earth. But if you look at the pyramids under the ocean, whether it's off the Caribbean or if you've got the city of Dwarka, you know, off the subcontinent of India, Malahalli Birapam, if I butchered that name terribly enough there, also off the waters, and you've got these pyramids off the island of Japan, and you've got all of these unaccounted for cities that predate even the flood and, you know, 1,000 years or so before. And whether or not you're including the pyramids in that, or you're including Machu Picchu or many of these ancient megaliths, they are sort of out of place with not only secular chronology, but in terms of how some people might interpret biblical chronology as well.
Okay. You cross over and discuss Atlantis. Now, there's no reference of Atlantis in the Bible, is there? I mean, there is... no, I don't... Unless you know something I don't know, there's not a reference to that, is there?
Yeah. Well, there are historians like Berossus who, through a city that is being talked about in the Bible, that would connect Babylon... Tyre and Atlantis as being the same city. So let me just sort of quickly connect that for you. So Isaiah 23 would be the chapter and the reference that you would want to go to that they're talking about on this when they're making that connection. And if you know anything about the giants and how they were bestowed crowns, and whether or not it was the ringlords out of Sumeria, they were chosen to, with the divine right of rule, and appointed by the gods at a central location to be the kings of the earth. And so in Isaiah 23, we talk about this old, old city, which is an antediluvian reference when you hear old, 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 and some other references like that. And when you look at some of the descriptions in Isaiah 23, this is the city of revelry. It's the city that's renowned of the earth, and renowned just as the mighty ones or the Nephilim were also known as the heroes of renown, the men of renown. It was the bestower of crowns. Pride was, and hubris, which is connected back to the Greek mythology of the overreach of the giants, and pride thereof is also sort of quoted in this, and God is going to bring down the destruction of the city that's called Tyre in Isaiah 23 as a metaphor for, I think, not only the future city of Atlantis, but the ancient city of Atlantis. And I'll walk people through all of that in the book. But he's going to bring that pride down, and the sea is going to tremble, and the earth is going to tremble, and it's a city island, and the fortress is destroyed. And I make a case in my book that this is actually talking about an antediluvian city as well as Tyre, which gets gets destroyed in a similar way, because Tyr's not really a island city. It's got a small little piece when it's destroyed that sort of juts out into the harbor, but it's not an island city. And so this is clearly destroyed by waters and a conflagration of events.
Who is described as a king slash or ruler of Atlantis that you can tag for us? Or are you saying that the Nephilim or the descendants of the Nephilim were populating Atlantis?
Well, there would be both humans and giants in Atlantis, right? Because okay. There are both races going on. And so if you look at the most famous name that comes out of the offspring of Poseidon and Climene, it's Atlas, who's the king of the island continent. Mm-hmm. So that would be the most famous name that would be part of Atlantis.
Is he good or bad in your eyes?
Well, I think he's bad. I mean, again, in the Greek mythology, he starts off as good, but they all become bad by the end.
Okay. All right. I mean, that kind of brings up my next question to you. You have a kind of a negative view on secret societies, groups that keep ancient wisdom and disseminate it only when needed, like the Freemasons, the Templar Knights, even the Rosicrucianas. These were societies that kept knowledge after the flood, after these ancient societies were destroyed, ancient cultures were destroyed. Why are they not a positive rendition in your work?
So in the creation of the secret societies, this is a manifestation of the other bloodline that's recorded of the human side, not the giant side, in Genesis. So in Genesis, you have the Sethian line and you have the Cain line, because Abel is murdered and Seth is born after Cain murders Abel. And Cain, according to Masonic legends, and Albert Mackey is sort of the authoritarian of bringing these old legends and history to writing, and he was a writer of the 1800s, and he's up there with Albert Pike in terms of respect. He pens the stories of the Polychronicon, which is the oral history of Freemasonry, and they take the beginning of their secret society back to this bloodline. And so in his teachings and in Masonic teachings, they teach that the seven sacred sciences were taught to Adam in Eden. And then afterwards, Adam teaches these seven sacred sciences to both Adam or to Cain, and then later Seth, because Abel is married. And these seven sacred sciences, the fifth one is called geometry, which in the craft they call masonry, and it's manifested in the building of the monuments thereof. And so Cain then teaches this information and knowledge to Enoch, who develops it to an incredible level, and I think to a level that's greater than what we have today from a biblical perspective, because Jesus talks about the end time being like the days of Noah, and his second coming being like the days of Noah. And if our technology is where it is at today, we're not in the end time yet, then that means that that technology was likely greater than what we have today. So Enoch is the grand patriarch along with Cain as they understand it in Masonry. And what's interesting about this, and just so that people don't conflate two different people here, is that there are two Enochs in Genesis. One is of the Seth line, who is in the son of Jared and is taken to heaven and raptured to heaven because he walked with God. And then there's the Enoch, son of Cain, who I will call the evil Enoch. And he invents writing and he invents the mystical religions. And then by the sixth generation, you have Lamech, who has offspring who will produce people like Tubal-Cain. So Lamech, Jabal, who is the one of the sons as well, is noted as the one who in the Antediluvian epoch developed more of the masonry craft, the building craft, from Enoch's knowledge. and you have Tubal-Cain, who is the greatest of the artificers. So they take their history back to before the flood. And then after the flood, this knowledge and this religion that partnered with the Nephilim of the antediluvian epoch, and this is straight out of Gnostic and secret society writings in history, I'm not making this up, usurp the kingships and start these great dynasties. And so after the flood, Hermes, as they recall, and I have footnotes and everything in my book, so it's there for everybody to go check out. And the book most used is The History of Freemasonry by Albert Mackey. Hermes finds the two pillars of Lamech that is going to have some of the information on there and where the nine vaults with 36,525 books of knowledge, the antediluvian knowledge, is buried, which is under the pyramid, which they also in secret societies give Enoch credit for building or creating the knowledge to build through the fifth science of masonry. Hermes brings us back to Babel and to Nimrod, and he partners with Nimrod to build Babel Tower in Babel City, and initiating 1,000 people into the craft. And he is known in Masonic lore as the first Grand Master of Masonry after the Flood, who writes the post-diluvian epoch, which is kept in place until Thutmose III in Heliopolis, over 1,000 years later. And so the reason why I look at the secret societies as being more evil in what they're doing with the knowledge is not that I think knowledge is bad. It can be used for good or bad. But these religions and these groups were designed to develop the sciences and the knowledge, but not in a way that would give respect and honor to the God of the Bible, but to lead people away from the God of the Bible, not give God credit for anything, and to honor and build monuments to worship their pantheon of God. So within the secret societies, you have a polytheist religion, which is diametrically opposed to Christianity.
Oh, okay, there we go. So it's actually taking people away from the Bible, the biblical history, and kind of rewriting history in their own way and creating a different religion. Is that basically the problem?
Yeah, exactly. And they're the ones who are part of the organizations that are trying to bring about world government, a universal religion that marriages with science, which is their Gnostic religion, which the Rosicrucians kept and garnered and then developed into theosophy to be that end time religion, which is offshoot of the New Age, that they're going to marry this in the end time as they bring about the universal government. But they're also trying to recreate the rebellion that happened in the antediluvian epoch or at Babel of Nimrod, and to rebel against God again, which is their anticipation of the new age or the new Atlantis, where they're going to have 1,000-year rule, where people are going to evolve into gods. But they're also going to have the showdown with the God of the universe. And so, again, what they're doing is they're doing everything that the Bible talks about, but they believe they're doing it from a position of good and light, but it's diametrically opposed to the Bible. And so both groups, as if you want to look at it that way, will both call themselves the children of light. And it gets very confusing for people. Well, how can they both be good? Well, that's the choice people are going to have to make.
Interesting. You talk a lot about a number of different figures, historical figures, and it's your belief that Akhenaten, pharaoh, one of the last pharaohs, the great pharaohs, was a descendant of the Nephilim. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I found that quite interesting.
Yeah. So if you remember what I talked about just a little earlier in the show, and a couple of quick references, is that these giants usurped the kingships both before and then again after the flood. And you have after the flood, after the Babel account, after the Eridu account, you have two pillars of religion and civilizations that are starting to set up that are going to sort of dominate the early post-diluvian world. You have the Mesopotamian one where Nimrod remains, and you have Hermes going over to Egypt. And so these are going to be, and Nimrod's going to partner with these giants after the flood and intermarry into them. And so the giants after the flood take over the kingships around the world again. And they start these royal dynasties and intermarry with each other ongoing to keep their bloodlines pure, because they go back to the gods, right? It's what makes them superior as opposed to the mundane humans. And so actually the Pharaoh dynasty, even though it starts off with a human dynasty, it is Nimrod's grandson after Nimrod has intermarried, who actually becomes the first pharaoh. And so as you get these bloodlines that are coming down through Egyptian dynasty, and note that they have all sorts of serpentine and cobra imagery, not only in their kingship, but all around the world with the kings, because their gods look like serpents as well. You have this intermarriage between the Mitanni dynasty or the Hittite dynasty or the Mesopotamian dynasties to help keep the bloodlines pure amongst these kingships. And so as you get down to the age of Akhenaten, circa 1200 BCE to 1250 BCE, you have the Armana dynasty, which Akhenaten is from. And if you look at Akhenaten and you understand how they intermarried to keep the bloodlines pure, and they do this to this very day with the royal families, and you have a good look at Akhenaten, you have this weird looking individual, and he looks like a serpent. And the reason why that's important is the offspring of the seraphim angels look like serpents because their parents did. They look just like them. And so with Akhenaten, you get this protruding chin, and you get these very high cheekbones, and you get these very narrow lips and slanted eyes and this elongated skull.
Yeah.
Right? And he looks like a snake. I mean, and this is...
He's a weird-looking dude. You're right. Yeah.
Yeah, and this is 2,000 years after the original creation of these serpentine giants. And we know that they look like serpents, not just from the Bible and my connection back to the seraphim angels, but if you get into Atlantean mythology, they describe them exactly the way that I've described, and only they give hair color. Now they give blonde hair and blue eyes and red hair and hazel eyes as the two sort of color tones with very pale light skin, and they're also known to have a lot of hair. And so if you go into the Kisha Maya, they will also take their descendants back to the serpents from this island continent, which you know, I think most people now conclude would be Atlantis, just as the North American Indians, many of them will take their descendants back to the snake clan of the Atlantic Ocean. So this understanding that these were serpent-looking individuals for long periods of time actually took place. And they absolutely were fearful monsters to look at. And they weren't just snake-like looking, and they had long necks, just as a neck means long neck in Hebrew. But they also had these thunderous voices, which is why you get it coming out like the bellows of Atlas out of the mountain. They're describing these huge voices because these weren't just 8-foot giants or 10-foot giants that we see in later discoveries in North America. They were thought to be, by most experts in the original creation, somewhere between 20 and 40 feet tall. Some people say as high as 400 feet tall, but nobody knows what... Nobody knows what an L is when it says, you know, 300 L's in the Book of Enoch. We don't know what that measurement is.
Yeah, 20-foot so. Tall human is a monster. I can't imagine looking at one of those skeletons.
Yeah, and not only were they big, and of course, in the Book of Amos, they're described like the cedars of Lebanon, and the cedars of Lebanon were the giant trees that they built all of the great sort of structures out of wood out of in the ancient world. They grew somewhere between 35 and 50 feet tall. So the analogy is there, but you can't really use that as an exact sort of height. The biggest that we can get out of the Bible is you have Goliath and Og with some descriptions and with the cubits. And if you're using a royal cubit or a common cubit, you'll get a slightly different length because there's 3 inches difference there. But no matter what, you're going to get on the smaller side, you're going to have Goliath at about 10 feet, and on the larger side, closer to 11. And Og will be, say, on the short side, 11 to 12 feet, and somewhere between 13 and 14 feet on the other sort of side, using the royal cubit.
Yeah.
But they were also had a height to width ratio that made them quite a bit stockier than humans. Humans are typically on average 3 to 1 height to width, and these giants would have been 2 to 1. So extraordinarily wide. And as we get out of biblical accounts and out of Greek accounts and out of Sumerian accounts, they were very dexterous, quick, fleet of foot. So not only were they monstrous, not only did they have a snake's head, these huge elongated skulls, but they were master warriors and were easily able to subdue the puny humans by comparison. And they're called insects and grasshoppers by comparison, even after the flood, when the Israelites are looking to take the covenant land from a land absolutely populated with giants at that time. Mm-hmm. And not only that, they're also called the Shining Ones in fairy mythology, Tuatha-De-Dananh, in Sumerian mythology. That's because their eyes shone in the original few generations. And so they were called the Shining Ones. And again, that's a term that's quite common around the world. So
do we find any remains of any of these giants, any of their equipment, weapons, bone? I mean, bones are so hard to find right now. It seems like they're destroyed.
And yeah, they kind of disappear after they go to the university or the Smithsonian, which is, you know, no real surprise because, you know, Smithson was a Freemason and a Rosicrucian and a member of the Royal Society, and his money went to Freemasons in North America and by Freemason presidents to start this organization. So they're controlling the information. Mm-hmm. So it's no surprise on that. But yet we have this hugely rich sort of chain of printed newspaper recordings of giants being discovered from about 1850 to about 1940. And I publish that quite regularly. I have a link that I send people that's got, you know, anywhere from 7 feet to 18 feet tall in terms of these giants being discovered. So we know that they have been found. Josephus writes in his accounts that these bones were on display even up to his time, which would have been, he lived somewhere between about 40 and 100 CE. And he said they were, you know, absolutely huge and a completely different engineering and completely different than a human body, which would have to be because these things would have held weight somewhere of, you know, 1,500 to 2,500 pounds.
Yeah.
So they would have to be engineered differently. And people would look at them as, you know, in wonder, even up to that point in time. And we also have accounts that come down through, like, you know, Roman history of giants. So it's not that there hasn't been records of it. It's just that it's almost impossible to get your hands on them today because they, as you say, they all disappear.
Let's talk about present day. Your book's subtitle is The House Secret Societies and the Descendants of Giants Plan to Enslave Humankind. What does that mean, enslave humankind?
Well, as we understand history being unfolded, you have these two different races. You've got the offspring of the giants who have been the noble and the ruling class throughout our history. And they've been pushing to gain absolute control and a world government, just as they had in the ancient past, all through history and prehistory. And so when they plan on enslaving us, you have to understand they consider humans as mundane, as inferior. And they only really vision a future for the offspring who have either the bloodline that they have or a DNA or genealogy that has some sort of connection back to this bloodline and at a certain level of purity. And so they would call that in the craft the gene of Isis, where they would say in the occult that the word Genesis comes from. And Isis was obviously a mother goddess and one of the gods of Freemasonry that they like to worship. And so this is also the spark of the divine that you hear in the New Age movement and religions and Eastern mysticism. And this is the spark that they're trying to unite in the end time so that they have this harmonic convergence that will allow them to evolve or vibrate, as they like to call it, into godhood. And so their plan is to bring this together, because they can only have this harmonic convergence when everybody is again under one government, under one religion, and under one ruler. And the idea that they're trying to do is present their own Messiah to make this happen. So this understanding of the bloodlines and that they've always got three Antichrist type figures ready to go in case the opportunity comes along. And they've been trying for a long time, and they won't be able to accomplish this until the restrainer is removed. This is why it's important to understand who these royal bloodlines are and how they work together even today with the secret societies and the mystical religions.
Okay, so I have to ask you this. So a lot of the ancient cultures developed practices like meditation, yoga. These were all about, and this is my understanding in my own personal research, is that these practices tapped into the resources of consciousness. It wasn't anything to do with secret societies. It was all about bettering the individual so that they had more qualities of the human being. And this is what meditation is. It's actually to help the individual. And I don't know where the evil part of that comes into. Can you explain that?
Well, it's the manifestation of what you do as you're trying to do that can be evil or not. Their belief is different, right? They're following their gods, which is the pantheon of gods and known in monotheism as fallen angels and demons that they're worshiping. Now, what they're trying to access is not only a communication with these gods, but also into this sort of a force or universal knowledge, and it's described in many different ways, but in the belief system is that and you learn this in quantum mechanics, is that, you know, all the particles are entangled, so they're all connected. And they believe, and again, this goes back into a religious understanding, and all of the scientists who understand and started off with quantum computers, they said you had to understand Eastern mysticism to understand quantum mechanics, because they're looking for this Atma particle that is an unknown particle that they're still searching for that actually overlays onto the subatomic particles and connects, and it's the knowledge or the God particle, and this is the knowledge that they're trying to get themselves connected to, which is also known as the life force. It's not only knowledge, but it's also a life force. So right. Again, people have the right to obviously believe what they want to believe, and I think people should make a choice, but ultimately you have two different belief systems at play here. And in the mystical religions, they believe in duality. And this is the forces of good versus evil, yin and yang, the good force, the bad force, and they're always perpetually at play, right? And one is never going to really win over the other, but you try and win an accommodation. And you see that in most of their literature and their writings. And just as the Freemasons believe in that same type of global Gnosticism, they believe that Satan is the equal of the God of the Bible, and that they will always be at play. And it's that God that they worship at the adept level, as they get indoctrinated into the name that they like to apply to their God, Lucifer, as opposed to Hillel, as it should translate out of Hebrew from. They get indoctrinated into satanic mysteries, and that he is the one that is still leading them and acting as an angel of light, as we talked about earlier, and is deceiving them into trying to bring about this world government where they're going to have a genocide that will make World War II small by comparison with the Holocaust that happened there. And that's a very good analogy for what's coming in the end time, the whole belief system, the government system, the marriage of an Ariosophy, which is a spinoff of Theosophy, and a government created by secret societies to create this Third Reich or this New Age. This thing has been going on over and over and over and over, and just as he's known as the second Antichrist by a Rosicrucian, Nostradamus. Mm-hmm. So if we understand all of that, then we can at least make some intelligent choices as to which side that we want to be on. And as they succeed in bringing about the world government, and the globalists are continuing to march in that direction, you'll see a coming together of the religions and a destruction of the Christian religion as we know it, so that it can be reformulated under this new religion that is going to bring the showdown with God. And at that point in time, at the last, the 3.5 period point of the last 7 years, this is when people are going to have to make the choice and swear allegiance to who people will believe is the Messiah, but he'll be the Antichrist, and to fight for your freedom from the oppressive God of the Bible, as will be portrayed, or not. And those who do not will be beheaded. And before that, the Babylonian religion, the religion of Babel, will have done significant persecution in the 3.5 years before Antichrist is crowned in the Jerusalem temple.
Hmm. Okay, we're down to it. So what do you want people to get out of your book, Gary? I mean, it's it has a lot of interesting qualities to it, but also, you know, like I said, the subtext is plans to enslave humankind. So what's the message? What's the detail?
What the takeaway is it is a 6,000-year connect-the-dots investigation in terms of how the giants in Genesis 6 partner with the mystical religions and the secret societies and bring down the anti-deluvian world, how they affected the history, what they're doing today, and what to look for as we get closer to the end time. So it is going to connect more dots and give you a better understanding of things than you thought possible. And it is loaded with information. It's an 800-page book, and you cannot speed read it because there is that much information in it. But if you're interested in looking at a view that is not widely talked about and in a way that connects the dots unlike anything else that is out there, then this is the book for you.
Okay, the book is The Genesis 6 Conspiracy, How Secret Societies and the Descendants of the Giants Plan to Enslave Humankind. My guest today has been Gary Wayne. Gary, what's your website so people can check out your book? You do a good job in highlighting each chapter, which I thought was quite good.
Yeah, I give a generous excerpt on all 98 chapters so that you get a very good feel for the book. And you can find that on the Genesis6Conspiracy.com. That's Genesis 6 with the number 6, conspiracy.com. And you can connect to Barnes & Noble, or Amazon.com, Amazon.ca, Kindle format if you want to look for the book there. And I also have signed copies available on the website as well. And people can also follow me on Gary Wayne, and I do regular postings on secret societies and prophecy and giants. And I'm working on right now where I'm going to put out probably tomorrow, King Agag and the number of Agags that go back to the Amalekites and the giants of prehistory.
Fantastic. Gary, thanks for your time and much success on this book.
Well, thank you. And thank you for having me. And hopefully we've given the viewers something to think about today.
Oh, I'm sure we have. That's it for today's show. Special thanks to my guest today, Gary Wayne. He came to us from Vancouver, Canada. Thanks to Melissa Tittle, to the Mars Revealer, Gary Lejeure, and special appreciation to my team, Mark Foster in England, to Curtis Hartog in Australia. and to my growing team. And you're going to hear more about this team in the coming weeks when I make a special announcement. Remember, starting in February, our next program, all about ancient Egypt, pre-dynastic technology, unknown Egyptian sciences. So stay tuned for those upcoming programs. Hey, have a great week, and I look forward to connecting with you next time.